cliffcentral.com.
Oh, this is all about Mabali, yeah. Sia pointed out this is about the sound of Mabali's beating heart now that she's got a crush.
Oh, man.
And am I making fun of you? You know I'm always concerned about the state of your heart. You know that.
Yes, you are. Like a big brother.
I get involved, though, whether you like it or not.
Like a big brother,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah, well, you've already got a big brother, but what the hell? You may as well have two. Always concerned that my buddy, she picks terrible boyfriends. So.
I do not.
It's true. I have to keep an eye on you.
No, this is not true. This is why
they're
my mother.
They boo people.
No, this is why my mother to this day is friends with my exes.
Oh, that's irritating.
She loves them because they are such good people, such good men.
All right, that is Tiggy by Sands. Nice. It is time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. It's flaming hot every single week, and people come here, they download this podcast. If it's the only thing they listen to that week, then at least they know what's going on. So when you get to the office and everybody's going, yo, have you heard what happened in the ANC this week? They go, yes, of course, I know all about it. I heard the Burning Platform with Justice Malan. And then that person who says, have you heard, shuts up and walks away with their head bowed because they know they just don't have as much good information. So here's Justice Malala. Good morning, Mr. Malala. How are you,
sir? Good morning. I'm good. I hope you guys had a nice Freedom Day.
Yeah, you were in Amsterdam. How was that?
Yeah, it was good. It was interesting to hear. It wasn't my first time in Amsterdam. It's a city I like. It's always nice to hear Afrikaans as it originally was.
Back in the good old colonial days.
The good old 1652s, you know?
Yeah, when those people came on their ships and, you know, all the shit started.
It just kind of something. They have an amazing exhibition at the Rijksmuseum, which I went to see, which it's so weird looking at South Africa from outside. And they had what I thought was a very weak part of the exhibition was on the Fees Must Fall. So they go through the whole colonial, the 1652 Dutch East India Company and all that, and end up on Fees Must Fall and essentially what happens with, not Fees Must Fall, rather the Fallist movement and the call for symbols and so forth. And we've gone through this with Roads Must Fall and so forth. And they focus a bit on that, which I thought was the weakest part of it because they just didn't do enough. You know, they took a bunch of cardboard stuff with, you know, Fees Must Fall or Roads Must Fall and put them up on a wall and said that's art. It was very sad. But it was nice to look at South Africa from the outside and see what people think of us and how we're changing and evolving. And in many ways, we're not doing as badly as we think we are, you know?
Well, we always think it's terrible. I mean, Americans think that this is the lowest point in their recorded history when Donald Trump won't do this or will do that. You know, the British feel that Theresa May is the most disappointing person in their history. The French are worrying about Marine Le Pen.
So, I don't blame them there.
Well, listen, something really interesting happened. I know we normally don't deal with as much international news, but you've just been in Europe. So Marine Le Pen was busy arguing, or it was a debate. It was a televised debate with her and Macron. And Macron said, yes, he had a really good meeting with Angela Merkel. And Marine Le Pen laid into him and slam dunked him with the following statement. She said, yes, we know you've been meeting with Angela Merkel. You need her... you need her assent to become president of France. Ooh. And he went pale, and then she said, there will be a woman in charge of France. It'll either be me or Frau Merkel.
Yeah.
And he was stumped. The guy just went dead, and I think that was a major win for her in terms of... I mean, it's not true.
No. The key thing there is that you can see Macron's... lack of experience in politics compared to hers. Now, she's been in right-wing politics for a long time. Since she was five. She's been with her dad and running the National Front and so forth. Yeah. And so you can see it in the way she's how shall I say, she runs rings around him in many ways. I mean, that the decision to dump her party and say, you know, thank you very much, it's been great, we got here, but actually I'm not with you all the way. I'm now going to run as a French presidential. And
what an interesting, imagine if we had our politics evolved to that degree.
And no, I know.
This is something I'd love you to just hypothesize for a second.
No, but imagine Cyril Ramaphosa says, you know what, the ANC is holding me back. I want to speak to South Africans. But, you know, so it's an interesting one that she could, just within days of basically getting 21% and Macron getting 24%, that she decided, you know what, I'm being held back by my past and my party, I'm just going to jump. I mean, it's a strategy and she'll go back to that party, I think. But it was very swift, and she was the best way for me to get ahead of this guy who is young, handsome. Mabale might make your heart beat a little bit faster. You know, all this stuff. But he, you can see how she knows how this is, I need to play this out in a certain way. And the way she's sort of taking the Trump playbook. I don't know if you saw the way she essentially stole the centrist utterances of a speech made by someone else. And they did a fantastic thing on one of the international channels where they had her speaking and they had the guy speaking who's a centrist. And essentially it was exactly the same thing that he'd done. And she's not ashamed of it. She says, well, you know, I'm saying the same things and I wanted to point to the fact that I'm saying the same things and so forth and so forth. But interesting election. And Sunday is going to be a big day for France, for Europe, for Frau Merkel, because...
Frau.
What should I be calling her, Frau Merkel?
You know? I mean, it just means Mrs., but it just sounds so German.
It's so German. But let's not forget, I mean, I find Frau Merkel fascinating. Here's a woman with a PhD. She meets someone like Donald Trump. You won't shake her hand. The last time she met Russia's Vladimir Putin, he arrived with a dog, knowing that, you know, she's scared of dogs. I mean, this guy. This time she's had a very warm meeting, shall we say, with comrade Putin, and yeah, she, you know, she, a lot of people like Marine Le Pen think she's an absolute horror, but I think in the politics of today, it's quite interesting that here's someone who grew up in the former East Germany, has become...
What you're outlining here is something I wish people would pay more attention to. Like, if you just read more about these people instead of taking a line on them. You know, we're all such complicated human beings. We all have competing ideas inside of us. And for this woman, I mean, I don't love a lot about Angela Merkel. I think a lot of Germans don't love her, but they respect her.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and she's got a hell of a story.
She's got an amazing story. I mean, not many heads of state arrive at the White House and speak impeccable English to Donald Trump to the extent that he doesn't understand what is being said. Well, then,
according to what I've read, she actually spent quite a lot of time trying to educate him on basic political stuff.
Well, you know, Xi Jinping of China went and met him and he said, oh, the situation in North Korea is far more complicated than I thought. Thanks to that 10-minute lecture.
Didn't he say the same thing about Obamacare a while ago? He was so anti, we're going to take this down, it's a terrible policy. And then after he'd spent about, I think it was 20 days in the White House, suddenly he was saying things like, you know, this Obamacare is a lot more complicated than people think. You mean the new thing.
You think, exactly. But Angela Merkel is fascinating. So she goes to Moscow, meets Vladimir Putin, and you know, he speaks German because he was a KGB spy. So he's done some work, let's call it research, in Germany. And she speaks French, Russian as well. So, you know, this is someone who is incredibly accomplished, incredibly complex.
I mean, to speak German, Russian, and English fluently. How many people could say that?
And she does a bit of French. Mm. She does, you know, she's, yeah. So it's one thing to observe that possibly the women who are rising to the top in the world are way, way more educated, way more...
Even poor old Theresa May. I mean, she came out of nowhere, but she's not an unaccomplished woman.
No, she's...
And the less you hear about a prime minister in England, usually the better.
The way better, because it means that they're actually doing some work and not being on the front of the Daily Mail or the Sun or something like that.
Not like our president. If you don't mind, can I bring it home? Because there are two things everybody's asking about and they want your thoughts on. The biggest stories in South Africa this week, and you could deal with them in whatever order you like. Cyril is here and he's made himself available. And he's out there in a big way and he's saying things that are completely counter to his position of supporting the president over the last couple of months. So maybe he's finally decided it's time to hit the road and start racing. Second of all, COSATU, an important, probably the most pivotal part of this tripartite alliance, because who cares about the SACP, really?
Yeah.
And have very clearly, on May Day, Workers' Day, their important holiday of the year, they have positioned, with the exception of Sdumont Lamini, positioned themselves firmly against the president too, and in Cyril's camp. This has been a great week for the deputy president, but is it enough?
It's still not enough. I'll tell you, there was a beautiful meeting between Cyril Ramaphosa. He went to the Shembe Church. I don't know if you guys saw the story, but
in Mpangeni.
In Mpangeni. And I think it's Prophet, can't remember his name, but the Prophet said to him, so have you come here to ask us to pray for you to be president? He said, no, I'm here to just, you know, to ask you to pray for the ANC. The guy turned around and said, look here, Baba, you must be clear. The last time Mangosuthu Buthelezi came here, instead of saying, I want to be president, he said, let's pray now. And he said, he prayed, may the best man win. And that's why he didn't make it.
Yeah, I mean, when the prophet, if, you know, say that in inverted commas, asks the congregation for a donation, he doesn't mean perhaps you should give a donation.
No, he says, you know. So if the Shembe Church has, and I keep on hearing the number 7 million congregants and so forth, let's assume that the number is true, but I must say it sounds a bit of a stretch. But if there are 7 million Shembe congregants, in a general election, that's quite a significant number, because the ANC got only 8 million people to vote for it in August last year. Mm. It had 11 million people vote for it in 2014 at the elections in May. So that's a big number. But those people, those congregants are not going to the ANC conference in December. They're not going to be delegates. At the end of the day, the play is still within the ANC and its structures, and who decides who goes to conference. So the delegates to the ANC conference, you know, you and I, we can say whatever we like, we still remain outside that key decision-making body, and that's the conference of the ANC in December. So it's been a good week for Cyril. I mean, if you listen to, if you saw the statement from the ANC yesterday saying, lambasting ANN7, the Gupta-owned television channel. Now, that channel ran a story saying, Gwede Mantashe, Cyril Ramaphosa, Zweli Mkhize forced Jacob Zuma to attend the Monday, May Day celebrations in Mangaung. That story is not true, because every year, Jacob Zuma, as president of the ANC, before that, Thabo Mbeki as president of the ANC, Nelson.
What an interesting thing to say, because effectively that makes the president subservient to those three. So they're admitting in that the president has no agency.
That
he can
power.
Be told where to go.
Exactly, that you must go.
Because that's not what happened with the cabinet reshuffle. No. The opposite happened.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's a totally new narrative to cast Jacob Zuma as...
the victim.
As the victim. I don't know, maybe there's a new PR agency in town and it's not Bell Pottinger. Because that's not what all along President Jacob Zuma has been casted.
Yeah.
But the ANC came out with a statement that says this channel has been playing a factionalist role, has tried to portray itself as being that channel that knows what is going on with the presidency and the ANC and will give you the news first. So on so many fronts, the anti-Zuma campaign has really been taking off. At the same time, Lindiwe Sisulu has been speaking. Baleka Mbete has been speaking. All these other candidates are now coming out of the woodwork. So, I think in the public space, in the public sphere, it's a good week for the anti-Zuma forces in the ANC. It's a bad week for President Jacob Zuma. No matter how you try to spin it, that was a bloody nose on Monday. It was a bloody nose, particularly because it wasn't just Jacob Zuma being booed. It was Jacob Zuma and Jesse Duarte and Baleka Mbete, who is essentially riding on the coattails of the Jacob Zuma, it's time for a woman to take over a campaign. All of them being booed in various places by COSATU members on the most important day, as you point out, of the worker calendar in South Africa and in more than 80 countries around the globe. COSATU is key for the ANC because COSATU, whether it's in its weakened state now, whether it's got 1.5 or 1.8 million members, or when it had 2.4 million members, that was, you know, if I turn around to SIA and say, yeah, as COSATU members, SIA, we are voting ANC. We are, SIA and I as union members, we pay our union money every month. So we are constantly aware of our union. It's a key part of our working lives. Whereas if you turn around as the SACP or as the ANC and say, yeah, you know, our people must come out in their hundreds and thousands and millions to vote for us. Well, you know, I don't go around thinking about the ANC or fall asleep thinking about the ANC every night. But I do think about every time I get paid, oh, yeah, the union has taken my money. So it's an organized force. And for COSATU to turn against an ANC president is a significant move in the tripartite alliance. What COSATU itself might need to start thinking about is President Zuma's tenure in the ANC has led to the formation of COPE, has led to the formation of the EFF, has led to NUMSA splintering off, and has led to the formation on Monday and the official launch of a new trade union federation called SAFTU, which many people are saying, watch this space, it could become bigger than COSATU. Now, does COSATU want to die with the departure of Jacob Zuma? That is a big question for COSATU to think about into the future. Because if Nehau, remember, NUMSA was the biggest trade union in COSATU. It left. Nehau is the biggest trade union in COSATU. Last week, it comes out and says, Baba, we don't want you to speak at our May Day rally. Yesterday, it's reported that Nehau is saying he mustn't even think about coming to the Central Executive Committee of COSATU later this month. If he does, he will be chased out of that meeting. Now, that's the second biggest trade union in COSATU, and it's saying we don't want you. The CWU is saying the same thing. Other trade unions, the NUM is basically saying the same thing. It's not a happy day for Jacob Zuma. It's tough times.
Sure.
It's very tough times.
So allies are turning on him.
allies are turning on him.
How does all of this that has been going on in the last week or two affect Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma's chances of succeeding her former husband?
I would like to, I mean, imagine all of us in the room, our fortunes are tied to Mabale's success as the premier of the Free State, for example. But we start realizing that when Mabale goes home to the Free State, people boo her. Oh, Mabale, go. We don't want to go back to Cliff Central. Oh. And now we are depending on her winning so that we continue to be in power. This is a big problem. What happens for Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma when Jacob Zuma goes somewhere and he gets booed? I mean, there are now songs. There's a beautiful song they have in the Limpopo. You know, it's like, where do you guys get these struggle songs? But there's a new song and they're singing them like Hearts on My Ear, and the same Futsak Zuma and all those things and so forth.
Yeah.
So Jacob Zuma, as a person, as an individual, as a political force within himself in the ANC, is becoming toxic for those he's hoping to lead to a win in December. And I wonder how long Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is going to stick around saying, I know we are with this faction.
Yeah.
Because that faction, the faction of Colin Maine, the faction of Batabile Dlamini, that faction is now being booed, is now being taking hits publicly.
Mm-hmm.
How long will she say, maybe I need to be my own person really now, and I must stop running around with this lot?
But if she turns her back on that faction, where does she get her sucker from?
Well, this is the thing, because that faction will suddenly begin to look around for someone else, or there'll be competition for its constituent parts. Ace Magashule has been nominated as possibly the GS by the ANC Youth League in the Free State. In Mpumalanga, Didi Mabuse is being put forward as a potential deputy president. So if she turns around and says, Baba, maybe
these people are not for me.
These people are not for me. They will disintegrate themselves because they'll start fighting among themselves. However, she could call him aside and say, isn't it time we had a quick word in private?
Mm-hmm.
And say, maybe you should say, I am stepping down in this capacity, whether it's as the state president or as that other president. Some formulation where there's a deal in the back room somewhere, and they come out outside and Jacob Zuma takes himself away from being the main player. That could happen.
But if that happens, what does that do to Didi Mabuza? What does it do to Ace Magashule? What does it do to Supremo Mohamed?
But the key thing would be to take Jacob Zuma out of play, but keep all those constituent parts of that faction going behind her.
Well, time is not on their side.
It's not on their side. It's 6 months to go. But let me put it this way. When we had this conversation last year, June, say, it was Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. She brought along Change at Home Affairs. She broke the tobacco lobby. She has been AU Commission Chair. She's got a medical degree from Birmingham. She's this, she's that, she's, you know, she wasn't. Uh-huh. Now she comes back, and all we think about when you say Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, you start saying, but Jacob Zuma.
But she's just his surrogate.
She's just a surrogate. She's a proxy. And everyone, if she says, oh, it's time for women, she says, yeah, no, but which woman? You know, people start saying, if it's time for women, there's Lindiwe Sisulu, there's Baleka Mbete, there's Tulu Madonsela, there's so-and-so. Exactly why you, or is it because you're close to Jacob Zuma and I trusted Allah, and so forth and so forth. So she's taking a hit, and I think at some point Jacob Zuma will face many questions from within his own camp in the ANC. But if she doesn't decouple from him, she too will find herself in a bit of a bind.
All right. It's certainly getting hot in the ANC. Just one or two other things briefly. There's been quite a lot of talk about this situation. You addressed it to some degree the other day about the advisors to Malusi Gigaba. But this week, some interesting pieces coming out from business about how they're not really particularly interested in the promises or the assurances or the thoughts of Malusi Gigaba because, first of all, his advisors seemingly can't make up their mind whether he trusts them or he doesn't or whether they're lying or they're not. But second of all, there is no guarantee that anything he talks about will come to fruition or that he will even be in position in the time frame needed for business to have assurances about what to do in their futures.
Yeah. I mean, we're going through quite a period. Our listeners will remember both Fitch and S&P Global downgraded us soon after the reshuffle. Everyone is looking at South Africa, New York, London, all the financial centers are saying, should we continue to put money in you guys? What are you doing? Are you going the way of Venezuela? Because your language is the way of Venezuela. Your actions are the way of Venezuela. And what's next? So the next big thing will be what Moody's decides. We are on 90-day watch by Moody's. That means that 90 days since the firing of Pravin Gordhan, we've got to, people are looking at us and saying, are you behaving or are you not behaving? It's a bit like Sia basically saying, you guys are on probation now. are you working out? Are you not working out?
Right.
Malusi Gigaba has been interesting for me because yesterday at the World Economic Forum, when he first took the media around and then he addressed the forum itself, he was supposed to clarify what radical economic transformation is and how it's going to filter through his stay at the finance ministry. Well, he only mentioned radical economic transformation once. Now, you go back to Pravin Gordhan and his budget speech. Radical economic transformation was mentioned 52 times. You go back to Jacob Zuma and his State of the Nation speech on 9 February. Mm-hmm. Everything in that speech, it started off with the words, we are going to begin a new phase of radical socioeconomic transformation. And from then on, it was radical socioeconomic transformation all the way. So, are we going to see any radical socioeconomic transformation? Unless you listen to the minister's advisor, Professor Chris Madigane, there is no radical economic
transformation. It's a buzzword, right? It's invented to appeal to the populists.
And that, for me, is an interesting one. You know, when you're at varsity and you want to be radical, so you get yourself a Che Guevara t-shirt and you know, you walk around campus saying all kinds of, you know, radical stuff.
The structures, the systems, they must fall.
Superstructure is oppressing us. Yeah, you go around saying that. So a lot of times I'm beginning to think, what actually is going to change here? Malusi Gigaba says nothing's going to change and so forth and so forth. So I don't think there's much content to the radical economic transformation rhetoric. However, I have to always ask myself, why did Jacob Zuma fire Pravin Gordhan if he doesn't want to change anything? Surely he wants something out of National Treasury that he was desperate to appoint Brian Molefe. And when he couldn't get his Brian Molefe, he said, I'll find myself another Brian Molefe. And he found Malusi Gigaba. So something must happen and something will happen at National Treasury. What it is not radical economic transformation for the people of South Africa. It's something else. and it has something to do with Jacob Zuma and his family. But something surely must be a driver for him being so desperate for change at that ministry in December 2015 when he fired Nhlanhla Nene, in on April 3 this year when he fired Pravin Gordhan. So there's something going on, and we need to be constantly alive to it. What is it? What is it?
Well, people, we can speculate.
We can speculate.
Nuclear deals. We can speculate some kind of financial situation which sets up the family, one of his children. Who knows?
Who knows? But I think we mustn't lose focus on that thing.
In other words, don't fall for this new buzzword.
No, don't fall for the new buzzword, but don't also become complacent that, oh, no, actually, you know, Malusi Gigaba has a nice suit. He's a nice guy. He speaks well. He's got an MA. He's going to get his PhD very soon. And so it's all happy, happy. It's the same thing. It's not the same
thing. He's a stooge.
There is something that went down in that ministry. The fact that Cebisi Jonas had to turn down 600 million Baba. 600 million.
That's a nice payday.
Yes, what is going on at National Treasury that is so pivotal to the Gupta family, to Jacob Zuma?
And if Jacob Zuma did care about radical economic transformation, whatever that means, why didn't he start implementing it at the beginning of his first term when it was just as pressing a need as it is now?
2009. Yeah.
We could have had years of it already.
Exactly. Exactly.
He doesn't care about
Since 2007 when he became ANC president, and now with 6 months to go, he wants a new policy.
And we know what frightens those people in the ANC the most is the EFF. Because they don't have the populism that those people have in the EFF, and the EFF's ideas, bad as some of them may be, they catch support.
Exactly, but at least this EFF is founded on some idea that the EFF believes in radical economic transformation.
They actually do,
So
it's
now
right in it's in their name.
It's exactly. So you start thinking that those guys want to do something about this, but what's going on this side? And I think if we're going to talk about this, for me, one of the big stories of the week is the new energy minister, Mamoloko Kubai, going to parliament, arriving in parliament and saying, guys, when we said last year, when my predecessor came to parliament last year and told parliament that actually we hadn't sold our oil stocks, we just rotated them, she was lying. The Department of Energy's officials were lying.
Yeah.
So we sold. Guys, this country is being looted. So we had oil in the, you know, it's like here at Cliff Central, we've got lots of content sitting somewhere in a back room there, and it's like it's loads and loads. It's a bit like what happened at the SABC, basically. So we've got oil, and then we say, "Oops, we're selling the oil." Mabale Ben, come on, it's $28 a barrel. At that time in the market, oil was selling at $38 a barrel. We sell it. We sell it, basically. We sell it to Sia and say, there you go, $28 a barrel.
Cheap.
Sia can walk out that very day and sell it back to me at $38 a barrel and make $10 per barrel. And we're selling, I can't remember how many
thousands.
Millions of barrels or whatever.
Millions. Who knows?
So first of all, on the day of the sale itself, it's basically stealing poor people's money.
Yeah.
Over and above that, the oil price, everyone at the time was saying, oil at $28 a barrel, it's got to go back up. So where is it now? $52? $54 a barrel? Whatever. It's above 50. So imagine if those people had bought at 28 and sat on it and now sell at $52
a barrel. Almost double their money.
They have made billions
out of stupid us.
Out of stupid us. And we can't even be honest and said we sold the oil. No, it's no, we were moving it around. Ah, because, please. I mean, what the? You were moving dollars around to your friend. It's the same thing as Claudie Mutsuneng at the SABC. Sorry to talk about people from the Free State, Mavale. You know, I mean, some of my best friends are from the Free State. but you know, you're sitting with you know, those of us who grew up, you know, who are young, you know, we'll remember that in the 80s you had all kinds of TV series at the SABC. You'd sit there and watch them on your black and white TV.
Yeah.
It's all been sold. It's all been given, in fact, to DSTV. So it's, we're sitting on all this wealth, okay, that belongs to the people of South Africa. It doesn't belong to Claudio or to the SFF or to the Central Energy Fund.
It's almost like your wife sells your house while you're sleeping and then takes all the money and says to you, I'm sorry, we don't have a house.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly, you know, it's, I mean, that's exactly how what's happening here. So, you know, this, it's a huge scandal. But has anyone gone to jail? Has anyone said who sold, who benefited from this sale of oil and so forth? So I think the finance ministry, national treasury, that's what we need to watch. Why was Pravin Gordhan, why was Nhlanhla Nene, why was Mcebisi Jonas, why were all these people moved? And when they were moved, why do we believe that Malusi Gigaba is in the position nje just to continue? There must be something, and I don't think it's policy, that it's, and it's going to come out. It will come out. Something is going to happen that will say, this is why Brian Molefe was hustled into parliament to fill that position, and when it didn't happen. And by the way, we haven't even spoken about the Deputy Minister of Finance, because he was hustled as well into parliament very quickly in September last year, and it was a quick, so that he could become either the Minister or the Finance Minister, the Deputy. And you know, that's a weird narrative going on there, which needs to be talked about a little bit more.
Justice, thank you very much. It's all we got time for today on The Burning Platform, but you can dose yourself up with this one and it'll keep you thinking for another week. We'll be back with The Burning Platform next Thursday, brought to you by Nando's.
Thank you, guys. It's been lovely.
Thank you.
As the prophet of the Shembe Church said to Cyril, if you want something, just ask for it. Don't say may the best man win.
Right.
What's that about?
You go to the counter at Nando's and you order lemon and herb, you're not going to get hot.
Exactly.
You order hot, say, you're not going to get lemon and herb. God damn it, make your choice.
Go for it.
That's right. All right, thank you, Justice.
Bye, guys.
CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. Again, I just got to reiterate, if you ever miss The Burning Platform, just like any other piece of our content that we churn out for you every single day here on cliffcentral.com, you just go along to the website, you find the stuff you want, and you just download it. You can download it straight to your phone. If you have the Cliff Central app, it's easy. You go to browse podcasts on the menu, you swipe to the left, it gives you the option to download. You can do it in Wi-Fi, and then you don't have to pay for a damn thing. It's the easiest thing ever, right?
Mm-hmm. Very much so, Gareth.
All you have to do is press that one button, download. You can actually see it download on Wi-Fi. Zero cost. And then you've got like an hour of stuff. Maybe even 2 hours if that's what you want. Maybe even four. On your phone. Doesn't have to cost you a cent. You can listen to quality content rather than just whatever comes up on the radio. Like someone who's just going somewhere, but you're not sure where. You'll just hit the road and see where it takes you. I mean, who lives like that?
Imagine we ate like that. You'll just be given stuff.
Whatever food comes your way, you'll just consume. It would be ridiculous. What if the intestines of a Peruvian yak ended up on your plate? Would you eat that?
Uncooked. Partially cooked. Unseasoned.
Now, let's get on to important stuff. We promised you we'd talk a little bit about this Van Bredaar case, and Mabali's got some new info on that for us, and Ben has got a horrifying story. He listened to a podcast yesterday about this very thing that Dorry tipped him off to. So, Mabs, we'll start with you. What's the latest on this this really awful, grisly, nasty family murder, which suddenly everyone else is interested in, but that we've been following from day one? Let me turn on your microphone.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, let's do that. That would help. You know, it's all going down in Cape Town. And yesterday, the court got to hear about how apparently three alarms went off on the night of the Van Bredaal murders. However, security guards on duty that night, at least one of them, Lorenzo Africa, says he did not receive any calls about security breaches and was not aware of the said alarms. So, what exactly is happening here? At least three alarms went off on the night that the three members of the Van Bredaal family were murdered in their home. This is what emerged during the cross-examination of Lorenzo Africa. Now, 20-year-old Henry Van Bredaal is, of course, accused of killing his parents as well as his older brother and then wounding his younger sister. Advocate Mattis Kombrink read out a report detailing activations of the security system on the night of the attack. The report details at what times perimeter alarms surrounding the estate went off. The first alarm was triggered just after 7:30 p.m. on the night of the 26th of January. This is now hours before the attack. Two more alarms went off in different zones along the fence, one just after 1 a.m. on the 27th, and then another two hours later. So Africa has testified he did not receive any calls about security breaches, and he was not aware of the alarms that were mentioned in this report. So how is it possible then that there's a report of alarms going off, but the security was not aware of them?
But this is the perimeter.
This just got confusing for me.
But this is the estate, right? The estate is huge.
Yes.
Again, like they'll reach for this as a probable cause for an intruder, but it is massive. It could have been someone who wanted to just get into the restaurant.
Listen,
or,
I know some of these perimeter alarms get triggered by a branch blowing against
or like a squirrel.
One of Lucas's rabbits.
Yeah. A beach
you never
ball.
Know. Huh? It could happen to anybody. It could happen for any reason.
Like a vagrant might have passed out from like too much Johannesburg.
I'm sorry. Are you both in security detail?
Yes.
Are you speaking from a place of experience?
How dare you question us?
We don't question your news.
Wow.
I've seen many fences in my life, and I've also lived in a house where.
Oh, is that what makes you qualified, Ben?
Okay. Let me qualify this. I lived in a big house once, right? And it was scary and had an electric fence, and the thing kept tripping to the point where our security didn't even come to us anymore. And it was kind of off putting because, as you say, like, okay, well, when we actually need you, you guys are going to waltz in here with, like, a wimpy burger and say, hey, what's up? Because you're going to be so chilled.
False alarm again.
Yeah.
Cry wolf
tripped
again.
All the time for no apparent reason.
Right.
So Lorenzo Africa, as part of his testimony, said, listen, I have to test the electricity on 15 zones of the 43 zones in total every day. And they always have to be different ones. There were no power interruptions that evening and no alarms went off, except Combrick said that, well, he has a report by a security manager at the estate mentioning at least three alarms being triggered on the night in question.
Yeah, triggered.
So now it's just become a case of he said, she said, or, you know, is the security guard lying, or is the report to be questioned?
I think they should bring a fence expert in, and they'll say exactly what Gareth and I just said.
Or they could just bring you or Gareth.
Yeah,
because seemingly you are these experts.
I'm available.
Yeah, we can do it over Skype. I don't want to go down there.
Do experts get paid?
Not in a criminal case, I don't think.
Oh, okay. Oh, then it's not worth
no,
it.
No, then we're not available. Okay. I just checked my diary. I'm too full.
Well, look, I mean, I wouldn't mind the hastening of this trial, so I'll go down for you.
Okay, thanks, Ben. You could be our official security spokesperson.
And I'll use my fence experience.
Thank you. Thank you for that. What a kind philanthropic thing for you to do.
Yep, it's in my nature.
I've seen
all right.
Many fences
so,
in my
what
life.
Else? What else is going on here, Ben? You listened to a podcast yesterday that Dorry, who's our content manager here, tipped you off to, and this is quite scary because the similarities between this case that you listened to in this podcast and the Van Bredaal case are striking.
Pretty much, Gareth. Firstly, crime investigation podcast. Yep. Wow, these are a thing, huh? Jeepers. There's one called The Sword and the Scale.
Oh.
So they opened up this podcast with this story. This was their first ever episode, right? So if you go into podcast, whatever you get your podcasts on, Sword and Scale. You listen to it, right? It is creepy. It's an hour long and it's so brilliantly produced. There's like eerie music. There's actual experts that chime in throughout the story. But basically, there was a guy called Bruce Blackman in Canada, right? Early 80s. 1983. This is when the crime took place. This guy was a bit of a, let's just say, different individual, right? Now, like Bates Motel.
Yes.
That kid. Think of kind of like him. Like a weedy little guy. Didn't really gel with society. Mm. It was kind of strange. Anyway, he didn't ever find any meaningful work. He was like 22. He was a garbage collector because it was just a mindless thing he could do every single day. He had, I think, three sisters, one brother. Like, he had a big family, right? But again, it was a family like the Frambois. Again, I'm not speculating wildly here. I'm just using a comparison.
Using your expertness.
Yes, sir. Well said. And by all accounts, to the naked eye, it was a loving family. Everyone was very together. Everyone was very happy and was very normal.
Sure.
But this kid was a bit, you know. So he then found a Bible one day in the trash, and this really upset him that someone would throw a Bible out. He then became very religious. He then got into his head the world was going to end and he had to do really amazing things because we were all going to die.
So bordering on mentally not particularly stable.
Yeah, and then he picked up advice like the Bible, and then it got really weird from there. But to the point, I mean, this guy really went off the deep end. He believed that by ingesting your own semen, you get closer to God.
Okay.
Whoa, that's the nice part. He also believed that ingesting your menstrual blood for women got you closer to God.
Okay.
So if I were to say, you know what, Sia, I think the two of us should go right now, rub one off in the box, and this is going to get us closer to Jesus. You would say, Ben, I think you might be swaying from the path of life, young man.
I think you might need some evaluation.
You might need some help.
Those would be my exact words.
This would be called an alarm bell in crime investigation speech, right? So this guy's maybe not so great. The fact he was forcing his sisters into ingesting their menstrual blood.
This is crazy.
Certain parts of the story I shouldn't tell you. You've got to listen to the podcast because it's creepy as all hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
But again, just like in the Frambois case, there must be warning signals somewhere along the line.
They checked him in for some mental evaluation.
Exactly.
So this is again a parallel.
Exactly. So this Bruce was then checked in for mental evaluation. Things weren't so great. He wasn't sleeping for like weeks on end because he was so filled with Bible passages and his own sort of semi-strange God complex. And another thing was that he was a twin, but he was very much the inferior twin of the twins, right? The other brother was like 9 pounds at birth. He was about 6. And he was just always like the kind of the runt of the two. But then in his mind, he created this perfect twin, which is like him, but just like kind of like an opposite, but they were entwined like this, right?
Mm.
And in schizophrenic cases, it's quite a kind of common case that these things happen. So he started hearing voices, right? And then these voices were telling him to do things. And again, the family was like, yeah, you're a bit weird, but, you know, we'll kind of support you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, with the whole thing of ingesting your semen and menstrual blood,
Jesus.
He didn't quit. He was telling his friends laughed him off. Then his family kind of humored him, and his sister was like, yeah, cool, I'll give it a try. Other sister's like, not a chance.
Sorry, the other sister was like, I'll give it a try.
Because she wasn't doing it, but she was humoring him.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the guy was...
Because he's unstable.
The guy was sitting around the house all day with no friend masturbating. I mean, weird. So then, like, the dad's like, okay, cool, go for psychiatric help, whatever, the mother. And they're all, like, kind of thereabouts. You know? But they weren't saying, jeepers, you are a fucking weirdo. Mm. I'm going to sort this out. They were all very, like, kid gloves with him.
Right.
And then, I'm cutting the story short. You've got to listen to the whole thing. And then he goes off to this other town, right? Now, this is all in sleepy Canada. Again, people obviously didn't think it was too big of a deal. Goes off to the other town to get another job. And then he meets this woman on this bus. Now, this woman's also off the deep end, right? Also with the heavy Jesus, believes in multiple lives because of, like, doing the God's work and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She got it into his mind that he probably needed to kill his family in order to preserve them in the next life. Something like, you know, like a really rational idea like that, right?
Oh.
So he didn't go to this new job. He went straight back home, and he started acting very weird. And the sister Now, there's various sisters around, but they all come together in the story. Sister then phones the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist says, please book this guy into hospital right away.
Mm.
Everything that's happened up to this point suggests that something bad might happen, so please get it done. The dad's response to that was, the hospital's like 5 miles away. It's late. Can we just deal with this maybe later?
Let's do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'd lock all of them up.
Well, see, the slight strange little bastard then proceeded to take a shotgun, a rifle, a really big gun, and shoot the shit out of his family. And he actually put a call into
that very night,
that early that next morning.
Oh, wow.
He then called his one sister saying, something bad's about to happen. You need to get it over here. So she's thinking, okay, I've got to stop this. She arrives with her husband. Husband gets bludgeoned to death with a hammer in the head various times. He kills the whole family, basically. Just like that.
Fantastic. What a happy story.
Yeah.
But then, how many parallels are there between this and the Van Breda case when you're listening to it?
A lot, because the whole thing was people didn't think that he was capable of doing anything bad, right? They kept saying, oh, he's
weird, but he's normal.
Yeah. And then out of nowhere, you go from that, you show the signs, and then it goes to like mass killing. To think, kill your whole family? And, you know, we keep saying, wow, to kill with an axe, that's like superhuman strength. This kid was maybe 65 kilograms, and he managed to kill his whole family, which involves some bludgeoning. So you get possessed, or you get some sort of idea that you're doing some amazing work, the voices.
This is 1983. Like, he could be dancing along to Michael Jackson's Thriller. Like, why? Could it be, yeah.
Is he in jail?
Well, Gareth, because he was insane, no.
Oh.
He did a little bit of time. And then they released him because, shame, he's...
And then they released him.
What's this dude's name?
Bruce Blackman. Apparently he's changed his name now to Bruce Moore.
I think he's next door to me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Slight problem, that.
But
I think I saw him yesterday. He was walking his dog. He did look at me a bit strange. I felt uncomfortable for a second, but then I just moved on.
So, Sword and Scale. Listen to the full podcast. I'm sorry if I may have butchered a couple of areas there.
But it's good.
Sword and Scale, Episode 1. Get the podcast. It's the full story of this Bruce Blackman guy. And you tell me there aren't similarities between he was a good kid and then suddenly the family's dead.
Well, speaking...
I literally have shivers running down my spine.
What a horrible story. All right. It is just after 8 o'clock. What we're going to do is come back with our guest for this morning. A family friend of mine for many years. I've known him since I was a little baby. Conrad Penny is going to pop by. He was present at the burial of King Richard III, who died in... yes, he died in the 1400s. And he was only buried last year.
Oh.
There's a long story to it. It's a fascinating story. It has to do with bloodlines. It has to do with genealogies. It has to do with who the rightful Queen of England today is. It has to do with whom you descend from. All these very strange and ancient practices, all these very strange and ancient families. And we'll find out all about that in a moment or two with Conrad Penny, who's going to join us to tell us the details of this very fascinating story. It's an ancient murder mystery, in fact. And you remember they discovered his skeleton. They found him buried under a parking lot. They thought that his bones had been thrown in a river, but eventually it turned out to be his bones. They tested the DNA in those bones with a number of his living relatives today, and they found that these were, in fact, the bones of King Richard III. And what happened after that was quite fascinating, too, because some history is only possible to map out now, thanks to the developments in science and technology, which have allowed DNA testing and all kinds of other interesting, quite complicated processes to figure out what was a lie of the Tudor era and what the truth is today. You know, history is always written by the victors. And when Henry VII beat Richard III at a big battle called the Battle of Bosworth Field, everything changed in the history books. Even Shakespeare was considered by some to be a propagandist for the Tudors. So it's an ancient story, but it's very, very interesting. All of that coming up next. CliffCentral.com.